Good morning and welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. There are lots of things that are inconceivable about Donald Trump, but the incoherence of his energy policy is especially mind-boggling. He's likely to wind up angering a lot of his key supporters in the fossil fuel industry because some of his moves, such as resuscitating the Keystone XL pipeline and starting a trade war with China, will have all kinds of unintended consequences. This morning, we talk with Clark Williams Derry, Director of Energy Finance at Sightline Institute in Seattle, about how Trump's flailing and contradictory moves on energy are creating new winners and losers within the U.S. energy industry that could wind up bitterly disappointing some of his key supporters. We'll also discuss Trump's conflicts of interest around the Dakota Access Pipeline and the growing movement to defund DAPL by getting major banks to rescind their credit agreements with DAPL and its parent companies. Clark, welcome back to Luck is Focus.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start by talking about DAPL, actually. I think that there's a lot of interest. Right after, was it last week, Trump announced that he's going to send in the troops to get rid of those Indians that are out there trying to stop the pipeline. So what are some of the weaknesses around DAPL, and how good of a chance do you think that Trump has of actually restarting it?
Well, it's very hard to say. The legal situation is very fluid, and I'm speaking as a sort of an outside observer, not an attorney who's involved in the various lawsuits against the project. But really, the executive order that Donald Trump signed could make it a little bit easier, but there's still some procedural roadblocks and procedural hurdles that the Army Corps of Engineers is going to have to go through. It was a fairly, I would say, is a fairly confusingly worded executive order, basically saying, you should go ahead and consider whether, for example, the environmental assessment that you've already done is enough. It doesn't tell the Army of Corps of Engineers, yes, you must issue the permit right away, but it's pretty clear that what's going on behind the scenes is that they're trying to pave the way for a quick approval and completion of the pipeline.
How does that executive order compare with the confusion of the one around the Muslim ban, the travel ban?
That's hard to say. I mean, both of them are creating confusion. It seems to me that the travel ban executive order created immediate confusion and heartache and chaos when it was put into effect. But the Dakota Access Pipeline executive order was more sort of a bureaucratic head scratcher. What do we do from here? And so it's too early, I think, to say that Dakota Access is a done deal. But certainly, Trump's attitude and his executive order have paved the way for possibly a quicker approval of the project.
Well, what it seems like we're seeing, with the exception of the executive order for the travel ban, was that Trump's executive orders are seem more to me to be an outlying of his ideology, and probably perhaps more the ideology of some of his advisors like Steve Bannon, than they actually are roadmaps of how to do things, or actually the means to do them.
Yeah, it's an expression of the administration's id almost. I mean, you would think that it would be, they had enough time to put together all sorts of well thought out plans in place, but they didn't. They just kind of like blah. They issued some executive orders without actually possibly thinking through the consequences of the rollout strategy or of getting the language correct. So it's very consistent, I think, with the way Donald Trump campaigned as a candidate. You just sort of say whatever's on your mind, even if it doesn't actually make any particular sense.
I keep having this image I can't get out of my head from Saturday Night Live of Donald Trump and Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon is actually portrayed by the death figure. And so this is just rolling my head as I'm thinking about it. And then at the end, Donald Trump is playing with his little toy at his little kid's desk while Steve Bannon is actually the president of the United States. But let's get back to reality.
That's important.
Something we can touch on a little bit later, because I think that is a real concern. A lot of people are starting to talk about President Bannon and how much influence he really has on what's going on. And it ranges. I think his interests have a lot to do with foreign policy, but I think they kind of cover the broad spectrum of the far right. Yeah. But getting back to DAPL, it seems that when the Obama administration issued its rule that basically said to the Army Corps of Engineers, you need to do an environmental impact statement.
Yeah, go back to the drawing board.
Right. Yeah. And that was done that way it wasn't an executive order. It was, let's talk about the sort of parse that a little bit about the difference between the way that Obama set it up for the Dakota Access Project to be killed, basically, as opposed to Trump's executive order, which would revive it.
Right. So, as you say, basically the decision on the Dakota Access Pipeline in last December was to essentially that an environmental assessment wasn't enough, that they needed to go back and do a full environmental impact statement. You know, and if you're familiar with the federal what's called NEPA law, the National Environmental Policy Act law, an environmental assessment is sort of a truncated version, a shortened analysis, and a full environmental impact statement is a much longer analysis that requires people to consider, or requires project proponents to consider alternatives. And so when President Obama put that in, you know, basically said we need to have an environmental impact statement, he was basically creating sort of another step, another hurdle, procedural hurdle that the pipeline had to go through. But in a way, he wasn't making a decision on the pipeline. He was just sort of kicking the can down the road a little bit. And now we see that when the can got kicked down, well, you know, one of the Trump administration's tactics is to say, well, perhaps the environmental assessment was okay. You need to consider whether or not you've already done the work that Obama said that you had to do. I'm not enough of a lawyer to know how that's going to play out in the end, but it certainly does, you know, set us up for a case where maybe the Army Corps of Engineers will do some sort of truncated review or no additional review. Just, it's hard to know yet. It's hard for me to know now.
But I was wondering, because basically Obama kicked in the National Environmental Protection Act, which is a law and rules that can't be changed that easily. How much effect can Trump saying, well, no, you don't have to do that, when this process has already been set up?
Again, not being a lawyer, it's pretty hard for me to say. The issue really right now is how much will the rule of law matter to me? Not to me, like not how much does it matter to me?
To Trump,
but to me,
actually.
The issue is, you know, what does, you know, does the rule of law matter anymore? You know, and it's going to really come down to whether judges sort of basically back America's id, or if they back our traditions and history of checks and balances, and ensuring that the judicial branch acts as a fully independent branch of government.
Well, actually, since you live in Seattle, kind of close to the epicenter of the big furor last week, I'm just kind of curious. I know, again, we will state you are not a lawyer, but you definitely have some interesting things. And I had a conversation on New Year's Day with a friend who basically was telling me I was being really naive and too optimistic to think that the rule of law was going to continue under the Trump administration. And actually, the next day after our conversation, or actually it was that night, I think that the House Republicans changed. They basically were going to get rid of the House, the Independent Ethics Office.
Right.
She sends me that saying, you see, I'm right. And then, of course, that gets rescinded. And then I email her back, well, that got rescinded. And she was happy that she wasn't right. But the conversation, really disturbed me a lot, because I thought, well, there's some credence to what she's saying. I mean, maybe there is no rule of law. I'm wondering what your feelings are after, like, watching the judge's decision first in Seattle and now the Ninth District Court basically standing up to the Trump administration so far.
It's clear. To me, it's clear that the rule of law is striking back. It is fighting back, and that America's judicial institutions are attempting, in whatever way they can, to say that they are a legitimate branch of government, and that they should, you know, they are not, you know, they're not just instruments of the whim and will of the president. They are, you know, they have their own place in the American governance and the American jurisprudence. So, how this all plays out, it's very early for me to be able to say. I can't even really handicap it at this point. But what is very clear is that there are a number of judges who issued the Muslim travel ban restraining order. Was a Republican nominee, so he was nominated by George Bush.
Bush, actually.
Yeah.
The more to the right Bush.
Yeah, exactly. So the notion that the judicial branch is just going to roll over and play dead, I think, has been proven wrong.
Well, actually, this reminds me of a time, I think might be before your time, when Richard Nixon tried to stand up to the judiciary and say that he was above the law. And
basically
said, if the president does it, then it's legal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. And I think that, I mean, hopefully there's enough institutional memory of people who lived through the Nixon era, who remember what that was like, and who vowed not to let it happen again. I mean, a lot of the people who are sitting on the bench right now were young folks at the time that sort of presidential abuse of power was going on. So we'll have to see. I mean, but at the same time, you know, not being a lawyer, not being anything, you know, I'm sort of in the same position you are, Barbara. I'm just trying to do my best to figure out what's going on in this crazy new world.
Okay, well, we'll do our best here. If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Clark Williams Berry, who is the director of energy finance at Sightline Institute, and we're talking about the incoherence of Trump's economic policy or his energy policy. And right now we're talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline and how Trump is trying to reinstate that. But there's some other issues besides whether or not politically it's going to go ahead. There's all these financial issues, and there's been a big movement in the last few weeks for people to divest from Wells Fargo and other banks that are bankrolling the pipeline. So let's talk a little bit about what that movement's about and what kind of impact that could actually have on whether the pipeline can be finished.
Well, the movement is fantastic. I think that the protests against Wells Fargo and the actions against other banks have been successful, certainly at getting the attention of the banks themselves. I mean, one of the things we saw most recently was that a Dutch bank, ABN AMRO, actually put out a statement saying that they are looking. I'll just read it right now. The bank has informed Energy Transfer Equity of its strict adherence to some ethical principles in banking. And accordingly, it's desired that an acceptable, non-violent solution be found among all parties. And it goes on to say, if such a solution is not achieved, the ultimate consequence will be discontinuation of the relationship. So what I'm saying, what I'm reading here is that ABN AMRO has been reading the situation here in the U.S., has been looking and seeing that, well, there could be a violent confrontation, and they're going to actually potentially pull funding from Dakota Access's parent company if a solution isn't found, that's not, you know, nonviolent sort of equitable solution isn't found. So what this is signaling is that this financial activism that's happening is starting to have an impact. It is starting to have an effect that some banks are paying attention. Now, the problem, of course, is that when you actually look at the financing structure of a project like DAPL, it is complicated beyond belief. It's a tangled web of intertwined octopi. You know, there are at least four different legal entities currently involved and getting financing to fund DAPL. One is the project itself, the Dakota Access Pipeline Company. Then there's the parent companies, Energy Transfer Partners, and there's Sunoco Logistics Partners. And then both of those two are owned, in fact, by a company called Energy Transfer Equity. So there are at least four different layers of financing that go into a project like DAPL. And then that gets even more complicated because DAPL has contractors who are working for it. They get their own financing. It contracts with other shippers who have their own sets of financing. You know, when you get into the world of, you know, multi-billion-dollar project infrastructure financing, you're almost automatically guaranteed to be in a place where there are so many tangled webs of influence and money to follow that it can get a little bit daunting. But just know that, you know, the what is clear is that these protests and the actions to, you know, bring to the attention of the management of these banks, it's having an effect. Whether that effect is going to eventually lead to the cancellation of the pipeline is it's not clear. In some cases, some of these companies say, these banks say they can't pull their financing now. But that's not a reason to stop fighting. I think that it's clear that, you know, these banks are starting to take notice.
Well, let's take the case of Wells Fargo, which is getting the most attention, and that's where, like, I guess, a lot of the protests have been centered in the last few weeks. I mean, here's a bank that was ripping off its own customers for years, for hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. So what's the chance of actually making any inroads with Wells Fargo, other than enough people withdrawing their funds from Wells Fargo that the bank flattens that way?
Yeah, it's again, it's hard to say because, you know, again, Wells Fargo may have to interpret its own financing agreements with the Dakota Access Company and decide for itself whether it feels that it can get out of those financing agreements, even if it, like, you know, even if it decided that the consequences were really high of staying in the financial relationship with Dakota Access. It might decide that it doesn't really have the flexibility or freedom to get out. That said, I mean, this whole idea of putting pressure on banks to behave responsibly and ethically, and using the pressure of, you know, your own pocketbook, the protests, I think it is something that absolutely has to get done to change the culture inside of many of these banks over the long haul.
Well, the other thing that's of concern is Donald Trump's own possible conflict of interest with his investments.
Right. So to me, this is really an issue of transparency. That because the president has not yet revealed all of his investments, all of his potential investment ties of himself and all his companies, he has not taken himself out of the management of his own portfolio. There's no way of knowing exactly what kind of conflicts of interest lie in his portfolio. Now he said things like, "Oh, I've sold my interest in the companies that are behind the Dakota Access Pipeline." It's hard to tell. And really, so to me, this is the conflict of interest. The key conflict of interest here is a lack of transparency and a willingness to continue operating as both the executive of the country. And the chief executive of the country, and also the chief executive officer of his own corporations, and that just seems to be an inherent conflict of interest, no matter what. And it goes beyond just Apple.
Well, it's a couple things. First, it seemed that when I was reading, I'm not sure, I might have been reading you at the time, so it's going to be a circular kind of reference here. But that, on the one hand, he sold shares, maybe. In Energy Partners, but he bought shares in Phillips 66 or vice versa. So even from what we can see, the little bit of transparency there is, he still has some visible investments in the partners.
Right, exactly, in companies. And again, Phillips 66 appears to be a committed shipper. That is, like, somebody who's a company that's committed to pay to ship oil via the Dakota Access Pipeline. So it's, you can be out of the business of supporting the pipeline directly, but then you're still making use of its services. And, you know, the Phillips 66 would obviously be in a position to, you know, to contribute money towards the ultimate financial success or failure of the pipeline itself. So, I don't want to talk too much about the conflicts of interest because I don't know very much about them. But the truth is that, you know, any time you have a president who is unwilling to release information on all of his investments or her investments, you're going to have potential for conflicts of interest. I think we should just keep hammering on the notion that, you know, our the American president should be transparent in how they are, you know, investing their money.
I'm kind of curious in your position as you're a researcher at a progressive think tank, what kind of pressure can you see that can be put on from the research you're doing and the research other people are doing that might actually force Donald Trump to disclose his financial interests?
One thing you might be able to do, and this is something I haven't tried, but you might be able to try to find some backdoor ways of figuring out where his money actually is invested. There might be ways of using publicly available information to get a better view of his finances. But that would take, you know, that's not something I'm planning on doing myself. But I certainly think that people who are trying to figure out, how does this web, how do we untangle this web, that would be a worthwhile effort.
I mean, there has been some really good research done. And then, of course, maybe if you're lucky, somebody will mail you a couple pages of his income tax returns.
Exactly. That's the other thing that I think probably needs to happen. You know, this is not, again, this is shouldn't be considered a partisan issue. This is just an issue of basic, good governance and transparency. And people who are, within the Trump organization should, I think, be concerned about the potential abuse of executive power. This stuff, I think, the more you try to keep secrets hidden, if they're juicy secrets, they're going to, many of them are going to come out.
As they did in that dossier.
Exactly.
actually, I mean, I've been reading a lot of articles in the last couple of days about all the leaks coming out of the Trump White House. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that and what, the opportunity you might see from that.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious what the opportunity is. The opportunity is to get, you know, inside information about the thinking and advance warning about the plans of the administration. What I understand is shocking. And again, you know, I'm somebody who works on Northwest policy for the most part, and on energy finance. So some of these broader questions, I mean, I'm just sort of speculating the way anybody would. But one of the things that appears to be clear is that the amount of leaking that's going on right now is unusually high. That is, that there seem to be people who are really anxious to get the word out early about what the president is thinking and doing, probably because they're just genuinely concerned. So it's sort of an interesting, you know, thing to see. In past administrations, of course, you get the tell-all from a cabinet secretary who leaves, you know, after 2 years within the administration, or you get sort of the leaks after 6 months or 8 months. It's all sort of part of the power fighting and infighting within any administration. But this is, you know, you're starting to get, you know, major leaks within the first several days of the administration. It's very interesting, and I think it points to potentially some internal chaos within the Trump administration itself.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting, I was looking at some of the theories about why these leaks are happening, and one suggestion was that the only way, Trump doesn't do any reading, and he doesn't really listen to anybody except a few people he listens to, but he does watch a lot of cable news. And so people who are working in the White House figure the best way to reach him is to leak something to the news media, and then he'll watch it on Fox.
It's just, you know, it's just a way of like running things up the chain. You can't write a memo and expect him to actually read his desk,
right?
Reach his eyeballs. So you have to send it through CNN. Well, yeah, that's possible. It's
not
hard to know
CNN. That. No, he doesn't watch CNN anymore.
Oh, well, of course, right.
You haven't been watching Saturday Night Live. CNN is in a little jail pen in the corner of the press room.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, anyway, so back to the question of sort of the inherent incoherence in Donald Trump's energy policy, you know, which is how we sort of started this whole conversation. If you look at it sort of in broad strokes, I mean, there's the obvious incoherence in, say, his continuing denial that climate science is real, and that it's, you know, his belief that it's all a hoax, right? So that's sort of a clear incoherence, because it just doesn't match up with facts, with known facts about the world.
It's those alternative facts, is what he
says. Yeah, exactly. So this notion that you live in and breathe in a world of alternative facts, eventually you're going to wind up being incoherent or out of step with reality, right? And that's that could be a huge problem. That's a huge problem for something like climate. But at least on climate, you can sort of argue that he's being sort of, well, yeah, he's wrong, but he's internally consistent. I mean, like he and all the people in the circle believe that it's a hoax. It's a hoax. It's a fraud. But it's sort of, you know, at least, you know, it hangs together. That what I think is fascinating is the way that his some of his steps, his moves, his plans on energy policy are actually internally incoherent. Like, that is, they're coming into internal conflict, that he's made promises to parts of his base that are conflicting with promises he's made to other parts of his base. Very interesting, and it's going to be interesting to watch how that plays out over the next few years. Because, for example, here's a perfect example. He's promised simultaneously to bring jobs back to the coal industry, and also to boost the natural gas industry. That is, you know, make it easier for them to produce more natural gas from public lands, to approve pipelines. He's going to remove burdensome regulations that keep natural gas from getting into the marketplace. So here he's promised basically to bring coal jobs back and to make natural gas cheaper and more abundant. Now, anybody who's been following what's been going on in the coal industry over the past few years knows that what's really been killing the coal industry is cheap natural gas. It's been fracking. It's, you know, this incredible onslaught of fracking throughout the country. One of the consequences is that it's been, you know, the price of gas has fallen, and it's actually cut into coal's market share. So anybody who talks about the sort of so-called war on coal, it was a war waged by natural gas on coal. So here we have a president who's now coming in and saying, okay, I'm going to stop that war on coal. I'm going to boost coal, but I'm also going to boost natural gas. So to me, he's setting up, you know, his core constituency in the coal industry, who were, you know, financial supporters, vocal supporters, and who, I guess, in some ways have been sort of, like one of the poster children for his ideology. It's like, we're going to bring back American jobs. They're actually going to be, you know, in worse shape if he carries through on his promises on the natural gas side.
Well, it seems like to begin with coal, it's kind of a hard industry to bring back. I'm not sure you can bring back Arch Coal and Peabody Coal, which are both in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And that there's a whole infrastructure that's kind of crumbling. And China is moving away from coal. And the last, I don't think China wants to import any more United States coal anyway.
Yeah. So and that's been a big issue is that basically, I mean, right now, U.S. coal exports are at the mercy of Chinese policy. It is China is the big has been the big importer. China and India together have been the big importers of coal around the world, and their demand, and the particular grades of coal they demand, and what they need and what they want, really has driven the market for the past since about 2008, 2009. Now, if you're starting to get into a trade war with China, then China's going to have absolutely no reason to want to take steps with its domestic coal industry or its import or export policy that help the U.S. I mean, it's sort of preposterous. I mean, one of the few things that the U.S. coal industry can do is it can export metallurgical coal to China, and it doesn't. You know, if China doesn't want U.S. coal because it's gotten into a trade war with the U.S., you've just really shot the industry in the foot. So, I mean, again, here's this incoherence. I mean, I want to be to get into a trade war with China, and China is the only place that can have any influence, or one of the few places that can have influence on bringing, you know, coal jobs back to Appalachia. He can't have it both ways.
Well, also,
go ahead.
Well, it seems also that China is pulling back from coal. I saw a figure yesterday that they are going to reduce their coal consumption by 30% in the next couple of years.
Yeah, so, it's been very interesting to see that happen. I mean, so everybody, you know, 5 years ago, everybody had assumed that coal was going to be king in China for the foreseeable future. And then in about 2013, 2014, coal demand peaked. It wasn't just the demand for imported coal. It's like the coal demand across the entire Chinese economy. And that was, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that and how that happened. But, yeah, it's on the downward slope. And some interesting things have been happening. It's, even though its consumption is down, they've also put last year a bunch of restrictions on coal production. And so one of the weird consequences was that even though Chinese coal demand was falling, prices were rising on the international markets because it was getting more of its coal, what coal it did use, from the international markets. So, and that now, you know, again, you know, just to show how powerful, you know, China is in the global markets, they made some announcements about that they were going to ease some of the production cutbacks in China, and prices fell right back down. So there are a few companies in the U.S. that actually announced that they were starting to export coal again through the West Coast, and I don't expect those announcements to be renewed after the first quarter of 2017.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Clark Williams-Derry, who is with the Sightline Institute, and we're talking about the incoherence of Trump's fossil fuel policy, and now we're going to kind of get to where it plays out here in the Northwest. And it's kind of the case of dueling pipelines and oil terminals and Canadian tar sands versus Bakken oil. So you said that if the Keystone XL is built, that it's actually going to boost Canadian oil companies' profits, not United States oil companies' profits.
That's right. That's right. I mean, like, you know, it's funny, like the you know, his big, or one of the administration's, or what, I guess Trump's big claims was that he was going to bring jobs back to America. He's going to, you know, America first. And one of his first moves out of the blocks on energy policy was to give a huge boost to the Canadian oil industry through the Keystone XL process. I mean, he's been invited the proponents of Keystone XL to reapply. He's been promised support for it. That is explicitly designed to move dirty oil from the Canadian tar sands into the U.S. market. Essentially, there couldn't be anything clearer. It winds up flooding U.S. markets, or at least adding more crude oil to the U.S. markets in ways that could potentially lower the prices for U.S. oil and increase the amount of competition that U.S. oil producers face. So I'm not saying, one way or the other that the U.S. oil industry should or should not have a certain volume of production. I'm just pointing out that there's a clear contradiction here. You say America first, and your first move is to boost Canada. It just doesn't make any sense if that's what you really are trying to do with your energy policy. And which raises the question, well, what is he trying to do with his energy policy? Is he just sort of acting out of instinct? Anything that Obama liked, anything that the left half of the political spectrum likes, I hate, and vice versa. If you hate Keystone XL, I like it. Therefore, or is he actually working from some sort of principled stand that we don't understand because he hasn't explained it to people? Are there conflicts of interest somewhere in his portfolio? Does he own pieces of the companies that would be benefited by moving Keystone XL forward? It's just not clear. But, on its face, when you look at his rhetoric and you look at his actions, they're just in conflict.
Well, it's also, I think, interesting to look at that in terms of our relationship to Canada and the change in government, sort of the shifting. I mean, Canada's gone from having this ultra-far-right, very petro-embedded government, both federally and in the province of Alberta, to becoming much more liberal. And Alberta's now ruled by the New Democratic Party.
NDP, yeah.
And so, and their policies are changing around tar sands. And I'm thinking, he's already, threatened to go to war with Mexico, and he's totally insulted the Australian Prime Minister. So I wonder what his conversations with Justin Trudeau are going to be in Canada, because in fact, Canada is talking about cutting back tar sands production.
Yeah. In the short term, that's not likely to happen because there are a bunch of new projects coming online in the next year or so that could wind up boosting tar sands production. I think most of the forecasts that I've seen, at least in the short term, talk about a slight increase. But the real question is how much more capital investment gets poured into the tar sands region in Alberta. And that's sort of a long-term question that has to do with infrastructure and profit potential and all sorts of things having to do with Canadian domestic tax policy and that sort of thing. But the bottom line is that you could imagine that the Trump administration is blustering about wanting to restart Keystone XL and having that come into conflict with legitimate desire by the Canadian government to sort of take a step back from the tar sands. I don't know if that's happened yet. I don't know. I'm not party to those conversations, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility that Trump is sort of courting enemies on both sides on both of our national borders.
Well, actually, I mean, I sort of see Justin Trudeau kind of reminds me a little bit of Hillary Clinton's policies or fossil fuel policies. On the one hand, he did talk about scaling back tar sands. On the other hand, he approved the Trans Mountain pipeline that
right.
would go from
right.
the tar sands to Burnaby,
exactly.
British Columbia. So he's a mixed bag there. But I still think that there's a difference, and I guess maybe that's something we can speculate. Who knows? How much Justin Trudeau's policies could be influenced by Trump being president of the United States,
right? And it could work both, either way. It could be to his political advantage to be seen as defying Trump, or it could be wind up being to his political advantage to develop modest ties or strengthen ties to the U.S. economy. It's just hard to say. Regardless, what I can say with certainty is that the notion of putting America first is, it's hard to square with the idea that one of the first things you do as president is to give a big boost to the Canadian tar sands industry. And it is another sort of contradiction. I mean, and that's sort of more of a local one on sort of trying to boost jobs in the fossil fuel industry. If DAPL is built, and obviously President Trump wants the Dakota Access Pipeline to be completed. What it's probably going to do is it looks likely to be the death knell for the Vancouver Energy oil by rail facility. There's this enormous Tesoro Savage energy facility. It's an oil by rail facility that was proposed for the Columbia River in Vancouver. It would basically take oil from the rails, delivered in rail cars, and put it into ships or barges and ship it down to other refineries, either in the Puget Sound or in California. It's enormous. It has a capacity for 360,000 barrels of oil per day. But much of that oil was going to come from the Bakken region in North Dakota. That's where there was a big surge of oil production in 2012 to 2014. Actually, I should say not 2012, but it was earlier than that, but a huge surge that went through 2014. And for a while, it looked like that oil by rail proposals were going to be golden for the oil industry because there's plenty of oil coming out of the Bakken, but not enough pipeline. And so oil by rail proposals started shooting up all over the place. And we have a bunch in the Northwest, there's some in the East Coast, there's some on the Gulf Coast. But since the new pipelines have come into existence in the Bakken, and it's not just DAPL, there are a number of other ones that already have been built, the oil by rail industry has struggled. And in fact, you've seen a decline in oil shipments to just about everywhere else in the country besides the Northwest. The Northwest still has its some oil coming to the refineries in the Puget Sound area. But everywhere else, oil by rail is in decline. And now with DAPL, what that's probably going to do is it's going to kill any prospect for any financially viable oil by rail facility here in the Northwest going forward. So here we have a case where it's not just a matter of boosting American jobs. He's in a position where by boosting DAPL, he's destroying another industry. Now, I'm not saying whether that industry should exist or not exist, but it's just one of these things where there's internal incoherence where he's claiming that he wants to boost the U.S. fossil fuel industry, and really what he's doing is he's picking winners and losers among different industries within the fossil fuel space.
Well, I kind of find it interesting. I mean, he seems to be more interested in boosting jobs in West Virginia and maybe North Dakota and in the Bakken area, but he doesn't care much about the Pacific Northwest. He's not giving us any infrastructure, well, at least in Oregon, he's not going to pay for any infrastructure projects here.
So no, that's right.
I'm wondering
right.
If we're sort of something he's a region he's wiping off or just kind of ignoring because there's no support for him here.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that it's a sign of somebody who's working in Trump's interest rather than in the national interest. I mean, he's clearly his instincts are vindictive, and he thinks that national policy should be an instrument of retaliation against his perceived enemies, rather than something that boosts the common good. It's another great point about the incoherence of his policy. I mean, like he does want to boost jobs in the mining industry, right? In the coal mining industry, there are only about 70,000 coal miners in the U.S. 70,000. It's according to the latest figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So it's not like it's a major industry. But if you look across, say renewables, solar and wind, the number of people who are employed in the solar and wind industry is, easily outstrips the number of people who are employed in the coal industry, even though it's a much smaller share of our energy economy. This notion that he's boosting jobs is false. He wants to boost a specific set of jobs. Jobs of people who appear to be his political supporters, and frankly, he doesn't even want to do that. He just wants to make them feel like he's trying to boost their jobs. Because what he's really doing is he's boosting other industries that are directly competing for the jobs that he says he's trying to save.
So I wonder if kind of the take-home message from what you've been saying is that we need, in order to understand Trump's incoherent energy policy, we need to be able to see his taxes.
I think that's right. I mean, that would be certainly give you a much better insight into why he's proposing things, or could give it more insight into why he's proposing things that undermine the interest that he says he's trying to support. I mean, why is he trying to boost the Canadian oil industry? Why is he trying to boost the one commodity that competes most directly head to head with coal? Even though he says he's trying to bring jobs back, American fossil fuel jobs back. I mean, why are your first two steps to undermine the viability of the industries you claim to support. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, Clark, it's always good to talk to you. I wonder if you network with people who do this kind of research and maybe help put me in touch with somebody that can answer some of the questions that aren't on your particular
sure.
plate.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Because I think this is a really important conversation to continue.
Yeah, the question about transparency would go, I think, answering that would be go a long way towards explaining why Trump's energy policy right now seems so incredibly inconsistent.
Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us, and we'll talk again soon.
Great. Thank you. Take care.
Sure. We've been talking with Clark Williams-Derry, who's Director of Energy Finance at Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with another Sightline researcher, Eric DePlace, who will be talking about the latest developments along the Thin Green Line. My engineer is Derek Crooks. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Cassandra Wilson. Thanks for listening.
John in my pocket, got mud on my shoes, walked all the way from Mississippi just to spread the news.